Be extraordinary. Seventh Wave Network.
Well, hello everyone. We are live today on April 2nd, 2008, a beautiful spring day here in Phoenix, Arizona. Hope you're enjoying your day where you are. This is Randall Libero, and welcome to Spirit of Film Conversations. This is our first show of spring of this year, and we have a very amazing guest with us today. But as you know, we talk about how movies are changing the way we think, live, and dream on this program. So each week, we showcase today's independent and visionary filmmakers whose movies evoke what I call the spirit of film, which is a metaphor for the movie's magical power to transform our lives. And we have today with us an amazing documentary filmmaker, William Gazecki. William, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Well, William's career in the entertainment business spans more than three decades. After being a talented record producer, He produced such albums as Bette Midler's The Rose, The Doors' Alive She Cried, and Greatest Hits Volume 2. And then he moved into a successful career in sound mixing for TV and film, earning three Emmy nominations for TV programs such as Hill Street Blues and a miniseries Foxfire, and he won an Emmy for St. Elsewhere. And then he turned to documentary filmmaking. So, William, what was that transition like for you to sort of move from being a studio producer to starting to take on a career as a filmmaker? What was your kind of motivation initially to make that career move?
Well, I was a Boy Scout when I was a kid, and I'd always been interested in, you know, public service, basically, to a certain degree, or you know, these kinds of things weren't quite as prominent, certainly in my Hollywood years, as they are today in terms of being aware of global warming and things like that. So I was, quite frankly, I was starting to make enough money to where I was able to start donating money to causes. And I started learning more and more. I started listening to the radio more. I started investigating more. This was in the days before the internet. So we didn't quite have the World Wide Web at our fingertips in those days. This is in the late 80s, basically. And so I was starting to get more involved in environmental causes and learning more about corporate corruption and, you know, a lot of things in the larger world that I really hadn't been paying a whole lot of attention to, because working in Hollywood, as creative as it is and as interesting as it is, it isn't always very conscious of the rest of the world. The L.A. environment and the Hollywood environment can be a little insular in terms of being involved in the creative process of filmmaking and you know, media making. So I started learning more about what was going on out in the world, and I had a lot of feelings about it. I had a lot of, you know, I think I come from a pretty traditional American background, and when I see something wrong, I don't like just sitting around not doing anything about it. So I started getting involved in causes. I started getting involved in various kinds of environmental causes and other things related to, you know, sort of suppressed information, you might call it. And that sort of led me on a path of wanting to do something about it. And I had been working in film sound mixing for a long time. And since before I had gone from sound engineering in the music business to record production, I thought I could go from sound mixing in the movie environment to making movies, to producing movies. And so I studied. I studied for about 5 or 6 years going to the various you know, night school and extension courses and whatnot here in Los Angeles, and taught myself a little bit more about production. And then when the new technology came along in the early 1990s, when you could start making videos on a computer, that was when it really changed. The tide really turned then. And, you know, I've always liked to be able to sort of have control over the means of production. And being able to use a computer to make a film, which is what I ended up doing, or make a video, was sort of the beginning of, gee, I can really do something. I can express myself directly through this medium with my own means. And that was really a big turning point. I think it was a big turning point historically for everyone working in the media field.
Oh, very much so. I mean, when I was in college, I was thinking someday we'll be able to do all this on a desktop. And now, you know, the students who are in school today, they have that capability. So that... I see that as a, as I said, I have on my website, I have a couple essays on there, and I say that I think today filmmakers have a responsibility to really awaken people to really what's going on in the world. And you, one of the things you said on your video press kit is that about having an impact as a filmmaker is that creating films that affect the way people feel about the world as much as what they know about it.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So one of the things, another quote from your reel said, the films are the way people can broaden their horizon or enhance their knowledge of the world without necessarily encouraging them to get out and directly participate in making a difference. Well, isn't that the purpose of a documentary filmmaker, to get people motivated to do something?
Well, sometimes. I mean, I think there's a current genre of documentaries that are very focused on connecting with very specific social processes, be it global warming, be it the Iraqi war. I mean, the documentary film can be used as a sort of a social vehicle, but I don't think that everyone is. I think what I was referring to in some of those comments is that not everyone is required to be an activist or to physically or participate in to go out and march in a protest or to really involve themselves in a movement. Some people are just too busy. I mean, you take a busy mom, who's got kids. She just doesn't have time to do some of that kind of stuff. But what is important is that people start to look at the world differently, and they start to understand the degree to which, they can be empowered in their lives to not be controlled, essentially, or to not be unaware of the larger processes in the world and to not contribute to them. So not everybody has to be a marcher in a protest rally or knock on doors to encourage people to get involved in a movement. But I think that just learning, they say that in the consciousness studies that, where your mind is at is very important in terms of the world as a whole. And some of that's metaphorical and some of that's actually true. And I think that, the more people are conscious and the more they're aware of the world around them, whether it's their immediate world or the greater world, I think the better it is in the long run for everyone. Mm-hmm. So, I think that consciousness in and of itself is just as important as being a physical participant in changing the way things are.
You say on your website, one of the credos, actually two of them you have, is the truth is waiting for you. And I am bringing to the surface something that does not have a voice.
Yeah.
And so, one of the other things you mentioned in your reel, you said films are really to allow people to have experiences they wouldn't normally have.
Yeah.
And just with that step and looking at another point of view, the filmmakers can have an effect. I mean, it might be small, or at least getting people to change their way of thinking, or not, but at least making them aware of something they weren't aware of before. Would you say that's pretty much the case?
Yeah, absolutely. I one of the things I think that is one of my pet peeves is basically self-centeredness, or people that don't take the time to have empathy or to have compassion. And again, these are really fundamental spiritual principles that I think that film can carry forward a long ways people's awareness of and involvement in some of the more fundamental principles of living a good life. I think that people tend to get very consumed with their own commercialism or materialism, things like that. And I think that film can at least help people find even just a spot in their hearts, or to just be more aware of what's around them, and to be more compassionate about it. And I think that film, I think that's one of the great things about movies. And I there's a lot of junk out there. There's a lot of junk being made, a lot of crap. And as much as I'd like to see film transform people, I'd like to see the film business continue to try and embody some of these principles and not just go for the bottom line and the buck, because there is a lot of that out there. And I think that bringing delight to people and bringing insight is very important, as well as uncovering the deeper, bigger, things that are covered up, or things that are really grand deceptions or grand transgressions against humanity those are very important, and I think that it's very important for people to learn about those things. But I don't think they're the only thing that should drive the documentary business. I think that's kind of where I'm coming from. You know, I started out doing these big cover-up stories and these social injustice pieces, and I think that kind of work is very important. But sometimes the success of those films is based on their timing. And other times in history, I think that people need to be soothed, and sometimes they need to be woken up in other ways other than just by scaring them about all the things that are wrong in the world, put it that way.
Well, you certainly had an effect with your early films. I mean, the first major documentary you did was Invisible Ballots, which was about the computerized voting system. And then you went on to your Academy Award-nominated film, Waco, The Rules of Engagement, about the whole situation that happened in Waco. And that really, that had an impact on people's view of Waco, because one of the things that had already occurred in people's consciousness, as you mentioned, is that it was a very complex story, and people already had their point of views set. You know, that was it. They knew what happened. They saw what was going on in the news. And then here comes along your documentary, and it shows a whole other story, which most people, because most people don't follow the news in detail, weren't aware of. Yeah. So what was the initial response that you got from the film?
Well, the interesting thing about Waco, I think, is that it was a situation where people would say, well, we already know all about that. Why make a film about it? And we, the filmmakers, knew that there was a whole story out there that nobody knew. And I think one of the most interesting things about the Waco situation was the degree to which the public had been conditioned by the media as a result of government control of the media in a very simple manner, basically. The government just controlled access to the press conferences during the Waco situation, so thus they controlled the information, and thus they controlled public opinion and public awareness of what happened there. And that aspect of the story, to me, is as interesting as what did David Koresh really do or not do, and what did the government actually do at Waco or not do. Because there was, that was the meat of the story, but around that was this public perception that, you know, the Branch Davidians were these child-molesting, bad people, religious freaks, and the government, who went in with tanks and fundamentally basically ran their home over with tanks and set it on fire, were the good guys. And so what you had is a very Orwellian reversal of perception, where the good guys look like the bad guys and the bad guys look like the good guys. And a lot of that was created by the manipulation of the media. So the reaction to the film was basically twofold. It was people who rebelled against it, didn't want to accept it, and people who embraced it and felt, and it could tell. The interesting thing about Waco was that people knew they were getting the truth, and that was one of the things I learned in making it, is that people do respond to the truth. If you tell it to them in a way that is sincere and balanced and, you know, well-formulated, people will respond to it, even if it counters what they think they know. And that I think, Waco proved to be very effective in that. In today's market, I'm not so sure. I think it's still true. People always respond to the truth. What I see going on in today's world with documentaries is I think, a little bit less of a sort of cross-fertilization between different camps. You know, I see a lot more preaching to the choir these days with film than in terms of activist documentaries than I think I used to. One of the nice things about Waco is that people watched it who didn't agree with it. People would watch it knowing that they had a different viewpoint than the film had, but they would still watch it just because they were curious or because they wanted to expand their horizons. And I think there's a little bit less of that today for some reason. I think that people tend to remain in their own camp and not, you know, sort of are not quite as open-minded to look at other viewpoints. And I don't know what has created that, whether it's sort of the Fox News phenomena where people are, you know, it's almost become, media has become almost like cultish in terms of little social niches. And this is one of the things that I'm curious about.
Well, I can say, I think people of my observations is that there's so much going on today, you sort of have to withdraw and sort of unsensitize yourself to what's happening. And that's why I think there's a growth of the, you know, spiritual transformation right now, because people need something to hold on to. Yeah. You know, the old religious systems don't work anymore. So, and young people are entranced with, the glamour and the buzz and pop of movies and video and all the other stuff. But now I'm beginning to see a transition, talking to some film students, is that they're really serious about what they want to do with the art. I mean, it really has changed dramatically, and they want to make a difference. They see there's problems in the world today, and one of the things that we had when, you know, you were in my age group, is we saw the future as a positive, you know, exciting, visionary time that we're all going to get to, and here we are, and the young people today are looking at the future, and it looks, they don't know what's going to happen. There's you know, most of it looks very pessimistic to them. So I'm very happy to see that, you know, young people are starting to get active again, and film is and because of YouTube and Google, and you can upload a video and everyone all over the world can see it. I mean, that's never happened before. So we don't even really know where the medium is truly going to go over the next 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, one of your inspirations was Charlie Chaplin. And here is a man who kind of, this is when the film business was young, and there weren't any rules. You just kind of made it up as you go. It's like Indiana Jones says in the end of the first movie. He says, I don't know, I'm just making it up as I go. It's just, that's, you know, and I feel that we're kind of at that point again today. Do you feel that's kind of what's going on in terms of the film business and young filmmakers in general?
Well, yeah, there's been a lot said in the last, ever since the technology started getting more miniaturized and getting more accessible to everyone, people have been talking about the democratization of media and how media will be accessible to everyone. And to a certain degree, that's true. I mean, that's sort of the YouTube phenomena, where anybody can make a video or shoot a small sequence and upload it and display it online. It does give everyone access to the use of the medium. It's a certain kind of use. I think that, you know, it's a non-professional use is how I would put it. And I think that there is some, you know, I mean, it's fun for one thing. And part of it is just it's an entertainment exercise. It's not necessarily only transformative. But on the flip side, I see things on YouTube that I never would have run into without YouTube. You know, it's almost like a Wikipedia or an encyclopedia of available videos on such a broad array of subjects that you can actually investigate and learn things on YouTube. But as far as young people are concerned, I see young people really wanting to reach out to each other in a big way right now, that there is a strong desire for connectedness amongst young people using the technology, using the various basically web-based functions of chatting or video chatting or emailing or you know, all of those technologies to sort of band together in a way that I think is different than in the past. I think the communication that young people are seeking is more visceral and more really direct communication rather than only identification with like sort of a pop culture thing. I think in years gone by, young people were more into identifying by showing up at a location of some event, say a rock concert or, you know, some sort of cultural happening of some sort. And I see less of that now and more networking, more people networking in chat rooms and more people networking, you know, electronically to stay connected. And I find that very interesting. I do think that the future is not viewed as it was in previous generations. It's very true. And when, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, people looked at the future as something potentially exciting. You know, when the Apollo space program was going on, and I was a young man during those days, the future was really exciting. I mean, Apollo, we're going to the moon, where, you know, it's the sky's the limit. Everything's going to be great. And now we've got, you know, peak oil. Oil's disappearing. The environment is you know, polluted. The global warming is coming. I mean, young kids today, they have no idea what's, you know, they're just emerging into their adolescence and being told that essentially the world's falling apart. So what I see is them really wanting to communicate with each other and bond together with each other. I don't see the rebellion against the establishment that was popular in days gone by. I see more of almost not a fear of the establishment, but a desire to sort of operate outside of it. I think what we're emerging into is a culture where people essentially are going to start learning to operate on their own, whether it's globally or whether it's locally. And I suspect it's going to be a lot more locally. Environmentalists are basically saying that if the future is going to be an equitable future for everyone, we're going to have to go local. We're going to have to get away from this global network kind of thing, which has its place in terms of communication, but we're just not going to have the energy. We're not going to have the oil to start to continue to transport things all around the globe, taking advantage of cheap labor. You know, we're going to have to start networking ourselves into more local and regional kinds of economies and societies. And I think young people are intuitively aware of that.
Well, that leads me directly into, I'm going to jump over a couple of your movies that you did after, which was Crop Circles, Quest for Truth, and Reckless Indifference. We'll come back to those, but we're in this discussion about the future, and in November 2006, you completed a film about the visionary architect Jacques Fresco called Future by Design.
Yeah.
And what was that film like for you? What did you discover in making that film?
Well, one of the most interesting things about making Future by Design was Jacques Fresco. Jacques Fresco is now, when I shot the film, he's 89, he's now 92. This is a man who, since he was in the seventh grade, has basically been trying to design the future. And he's always been interested in the future his whole life, since he was a kid in the 1920s. He spent many years being an inventor, inventing products to help improve life for people. And after doing that for about 30 years, he realized, you know, I'm not going to change the world just inventing better devices and better tools. I think the world needs more than that. I think it needs a bigger assessment and reassessment. So he changed his direction in the 1950s and started looking at larger social systems and larger economic systems, and basically proceeded to establish a concept, a theory, of the world of the future that included not only technology but social systems and almost like psychological systems. He almost kind of reapproached, you know, our psychology, because he's a man who believes that there's a lot to be said for our behavior, that if we can retrain some of our behavior, we might not be quite so harmful to the environment, for example. And one of the things I'm talking about are characteristics like greed and hunger for power. And his feeling is that, you know, those kinds of characteristics of people are part of what's made the world what it is today, which is not as good as it could be. That people who vie for power or hunger for domination really are not doing, you know, a service to the rest of humanity. And that people aren't just born that way. That you can actually sort of retrain through generations, people to be fundamentally more caring and less concerned about themselves. And I think he's onto something. I think that, you know, besides new technologies that can, you know, reduce the workload and make things more efficient and aggregate information and the things that we're dealing with a lot now, I think that he's got some very interesting ideas about how humanity can transform themselves socially and internally. So that I tend to agree that most people in the world are good people. And the idea is, what do we need to do to create a society where people actually have a will and a desire to not be at war, and to not dominate one another, and to not steal, and to not do all the things that really create, you know, long-term historical problems? And I think Fresco is onto something. That's a big part of his work that I found quite fascinating.
Well, his work is truly unprecedented. He's a living original genius. And on the back of the film, you say he's a modern day Da Vinci. I, from watching the movie, as he was talking about the architecture of creating sort of communities and how people would live together in community, I really began to feel, you know, this would really work. This would really, I mean, I would want to live in a place that looks like that. I would feel it would look harmonious. It's architecturally beautiful. It has a certain sacred geometry and its structure. And you share places with people. Everything, you kind of walk around and you come back to the circle where you started, you know, like a couple buildings like that.
Sure.
And I really thought, you know, this is a future that I would want for my kids. I have my son watching it, who likes to draw, you know, three-dimensional, you know, spaceships and things like that.
Right.
And he was really taken with it. He'd never seen anything like that before. And I could see in his face that, you know, that kind of a place would really appeal to him. And I think because it takes on the settings of nature around it, and it provides a place where, you know, today's buildings, they sort of stick up and they don't blend into the landscape and that kind of a thing. And this was all, it worked like it was just kind of put all together. Anyway, we're going to come back after a short break with William Gazecki, about 2 minutes, and we'll return right here on Spirit of Film Conversations. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Be extraordinary. Seventh Wave Network.
Are you self-employed or do you run a small business? Then you wear a lot of hats. You're the CEO, sales manager, benefits manager, and sometimes even the janitor. You need to know about the National Association for the Self-Employed. The NASE offers you access to affordable health insurance, dental plans, vision plans, income protection plans, and term life insurance. They even provide access to business advice, tax advice, and emergency road service. Insurance plans are provided by the Mega Life and Health Insurance Company, North Richland Hills, Texas, and there are some exclusions and limitations. So call now to learn how we can help your small business grow.
800-327-0580. 800-327-0580. Not licensed in New York. Policy series on file and association membership is required. Call now. 800-327-0580. 800-327-0580.
Whether you're a baby boomer, a post-baby boomer, or a young up-and-coming, we can guide your stride. Host Cindy Spear will enlighten, educate, and entice you, our listener, to realize that you are in control of your life. No longer will the economy, media, employers, neighbors, or relatives, not even the dog, come between you and your unlimited potential. Tune in to Baby Boomers of Today. Where do we go from here? Tuesdays at 1 p.m. Pacific on the 7th Wave Network.
Taking you to the threshold of a dream and beyond. Seventh Wave Network.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to Spirit of Film Conversations. I'm your host, Randall Libero, and we're speaking today with a filmmaker profile of Mr. William Gazecki. And you can check out his website. I'll spell it for you. It's William, G-A-Z-E-C-K-I, or you can go to spiritoffilm.net and find out more information about our guest today. William, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, on your website, just I want to point this out because all of our audience out there who are filmmakers, both in the biz and independent, there's a great link on your website that says the community, and there's a wealth of links there for anyone who is interested in getting more information and making their films, just finding places for distribution, networking, and all sorts of things. So that's a great service that you provided on your website there. We were talking before the break about Future by Design, and I want to move to another film which had a very unique subject. It was a film that you did after Waco. It's called Crop Circles, Quest for Truth. Yeah. And I noticed one of the things I want to mention in your documentaries is that some documentaries sort of, the approach of the filmmaker is where they sort of take you on their personal journey. But the way that you edit your film was what I call my terminology for it, of sort of a deck of cards. In other words, your sound from one clip doesn't bleed over into the next and talk over that visual. You let each audio and video piece stand on its own. And then as a filmmaker, that's your presentation. So to the viewer, they get one piece of information at a time, and they're looking at it as a complete piece, and then they move on to the next one and the next and the next and the next. In Crop Circles, because we're seeing something that is so highly unusual, what was your kind of approach on your thoughts on how you would approach the subject? Because most people at that time, when you made the film in the 90s, they were really unfamiliar with this.
I didn't know what crop circles were. myself. I first learned about them in the early 90s. I went to a lecture here in Santa Monica, California, of two or three older British gentlemen in their, you know, mid-50s to early 60s anyway. And they were all like, one was a civil engineer and one was some kind of a professional. I mean, these were, you know, pretty accomplished adult British men coming over talking about crop circles and showing pictures and talking about the phenomena, talking about the anomalies and their different experiences. And it was a fascinating juxtaposition of this very far-out paranormal stuff and these very sort of conservative British gentlemen talking about it. It was a very interesting mix that really caught my attention because it wasn't your typical sort of, you know, wide-eyed, fascinated, kind of, you know, heightened enthusiast presentation. It was much more measured and staid. And so that piqued my interest, and I started really just over the years, throughout the 90s, kind of monitored what crop circles were, kind of waiting to see what it might be about and all this sort of thing. Because it was unusual. They're very beautiful, but they're very hard to kind of pin down. So when I actually went over to England was when I really became enamored with the whole subject and did learn that it's a very, very real phenomena. It is not a bunch of guys with planks and boards, although there are people who make them. You know, there are people who are trying purposely to deceive the public or to express themselves through art, land art, as they call it, whatever it is those people are doing that make them. That's separate from the what I would call the authentic phenomena, which is a mystery. These formations, and they are exquisitely designed and very significant. Some of them are very significant in terms of their symbology. And there is something going on. Most of it is in England, although it does take place in other countries around the world quite a bit, more and more as the years go by. There is something going on. Something is happening, and it is being expressed in the fields in making these formations, in making these glyphs, as they're called. And I wanted to capture that in my film. I wanted to honor the reality of it. You know, I didn't want to just do yet another, is this real or not? You know, let's prove it's real. Let's prove it's not real. You know, that's been done. It's been done many times with crop circles, and it never gets anywhere. You still have people who believe, people who don't believe, you know, whatever. And I wanted to make a film that was an honest reflection of my experience and of the people, too, because I felt that the people, just like the British gentleman that I saw in the very first lecture, the people I met over in England who are involved in crop circles are smart, they're mature, they're aware, they're savvy. You know, they're not a bunch of wide-eyed, you know, followers in some cult. I mean, the crop circle phenomena is a very sophisticated situation. It gets bad-mouthed by the press, which I do not understand, because it is authentic. Actually, I shouldn't say I don't understand why the press treats it like it does. There are reasons, you know. I don't think the press has the sophistication to deal with a subject like crop circles intelligently or comprehensively.
To be on their reality, they can't understand, and so they
don't
talk about it.
Yeah, and it's an easy target too. It's an easy target to make fun of. It's easier
UFOs,
to gain,
right?
Yeah, it's easier to gain traction making fun of crop circles than it is taking it seriously. It's a very childish, basically childish approach, I think. So.
Yeah, it is a genuine mystery, and I think, as you mentioned, that you really wanted to give people a sense of what the authentic phenomenon is like, and you talked about a reaction of a young man who saw the film, who had never seen anything like it before, yeah. Didn't even know about it, and his reaction when he saw it, and you asked him, sitting in the back of the theater, and he said, I don't know, I'm kind of scared,
right.
And that was, you know, it was challenging to his belief system,
yeah.
So...
Yeah. I asked him, why are you scared? He said, because it's probably real.
Yeah.
And even though what he was seeing was very gentle and very, you know, the film itself is not a scary, confrontational thing at all. It's really a delightful watch and an interesting, fascinating film to watch. But he was scared because he could tell that it wasn't hype, that it was probably real, and that confronted his reality. As gentle as the crop circles are and as unthreatening as they are, their mere existence, really considering the reality of their existence, does make people nervous. And that's just a comment on humanity. That's just a comment on our collective state in terms of, you know, we tend to think of ourselves as, we can handle it. Well, that's not necessarily true when it really gets down to brass tacks.
Yeah, you sort of, you've got to get through your own filters of disbelief to expand your horizon, so to speak.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's one thing to see a new Spider-Man 4 movie or to see, you know, something that's new, but at the same time, it really isn't new. It's just sort of an iteration of something that we're familiar with. The difference between that and something that's really different is significant. And I think crop circles represent that. And I have a real soft spot for crop circles. I think that there's something really wonderful behind the crop circle phenomena. The experience of being over there was very unique. And I spent about 2 months in England working with the crop circle researchers, being around crop circles, having them appear close to where I was staying, and they're not man-made ones, because the man-made ones you can tell. If you go on the ground into a man-made one, it's really obvious the difference between those and the real ones. The real ones have all sorts of artistry, very subtle, complex artistry in the way in which they're put together that is really apparent. It cannot be done by human hands.
Yeah, and they evoke very complex mathematics in another hand. That's what's amazing to me is that the guys have figured out the certain angles of these things, and they apply to, the orbital velocities of planets and things like that. And I don't know how they figure that stuff out, but
the sacred geometry, as they call it, involved in crop circles, is profound, and that's one of the little more important niches that I think that the general journalism and news organizations just completely, they can't even comprehend. They don't even go there. And that's very unfortunate, very sad, because there is so much richness that has been drawn from the study of crop circles, whether it's historical, geometric, sacred geometry, symbology. I mean, there's a lot of data that has been compiled now that is very, very well researched data. I mean, there's a lot of German, British, and Danish researchers that have now spent 10, 15 years compiling data about crop circles and what kind of information they embody. And it's just been ignored by my biggest concern, my biggest worry or beef with this is that academia in general hasn't bothered to pick up on this. There's a weird sort of bias against the crop circle phenomena because it's related to UFOs and because it's associated with other stuff that, you know, is even more difficult to grok or to cope with. It's been ostracized, and it really should. It really deserves authentic study.
Yeah, I mean, you know, seeing a UFO, I mean, not everyone's seen one, but the people who do are deeply affected by it when they see something up in the sky. And I've seen a number of things that, for the life of me, I don't know what was going on when I was looking at it. You know, driving to Las Vegas, I'm seeing these bright flashes on the side of the road. There's like a giant flashbulb going off, and it's right near the Air Force Base. And I'm going, okay, well, there's something going on there. Then on the other side, I'm seeing lights floating around in the sky. So if you keep your eyes open, you're going to see something. And the crop circles are, it's so obvious. I mean, at one point in the movie, there was a guy that says overnight, I mean, 14 of them appeared in different places. I mean, you don't have a million guys out there making these, obviously, So, and then, you know, there are never any mistakes. There are never any half-finished designs. No one's caught in the act. I mean, you know, these things are very real. So what are, you know, as you said, are we going to look at this and embrace it and say this is a mystery and let's figure it out and let's expand our horizons? But, you know, people are, they're nervous to do that. And I think your film really makes a very strong point that, you know, it really is, we're at this point in society right now where we have to take the step of opening up to our sense of wonder, not a sense of being innocent, but a sense of our wonder, just like, you know, looking at the horizons, you know, when we were younger, looking at the space program. And I think we've become closed off. And films are reflecting, you know, in the history of the movie business, when people get nervous, they get a lot of entertainment-based, you know, sort of namby-pamby type movies, and we're seeing a lot of comic book things right now, and I think that, again, is going to change, because films always reflect the culture.
Yeah, well, exactly, and we are going somewhere in our world. I think that's one of the things, when we talk about crop circles, why are crop circles here now? There's evidence that they've kind of appeared here and there over time, over the centuries, basically, but they are here now in a big way, and they are evolving. Every year they get more and more complex. It seems to be apparent to the people that are studying them that there is information that is trying to be expressed, that there's a reason for crop circles to be made. It's not just for our entertainment. There's something else going on.
Well, some intelligence wants to communicate to us.
Yes, and what the people who are very deeply involved in this, because there are new things going on right now in terms of crop circles that is starting to now break out of more than just bent over plants in the fields. There are other phenomena that are starting to occur more readily in a few places with a few researchers. And so now the body of information is starting to indicate that crop circles are not just a passive phenomena, that there's actually an intention or a reason for them to be here. And it may relate to our evolution as a species or as a planet, because we are in a very, very tumultuous time right now. We are approaching, you know, we have 2012 coming up, which is, there's a lot of mythology around that and a lot of belief around that, and that's going to be coming up pretty soon. But even irrespective of that, we are clearly at a moment in our evolution as a species with our population growth, our resource consumption. I mean, you know, these are very real things that we're just learning now how to cope with talking about or measuring, and it's going by fast. I mean, we are moving fast. We're using up our oil, we're using up our water, we're using up our resources really fast. Our population is expanding really fast, and I from what I can tell, from what information I've been able to share with other researchers and whatnot, the crop circle phenomena does somehow relate to something that has to do with the bigger picture of humanity and our evolution. And maybe it's, you use the term wonderment. There's also understanding the larger spiritual principles of the universe and the ultimate sort of right versus wrong, good versus bad, right direction versus wrong direction kind of path. And crop circles may have some bearing on that ultimately.
Yeah, they're teaching us a way to communicate through, in a different way. They're teaching us a language.
They're teaching us that the world is sacred at one level, you know, that the world really is sacred, and that, you know, it's not just manifest destiny. It's not just all at our feet to use any way we want willy-nilly. You know, that is an old concept that really is antiquated. We can't survive. You know, the American standard of living cannot be duplicated around the world. There's not enough resources. And we have been sort of a cultural leader on the planet for quality of life. Unfortunately, our quality of life is very wasteful and very resource-based, very resource-intensive. And we're a model, and we've become a model for many other parts of the world, like Russia and China, that are now, you know, taking over economically. But in order to live at our quality of life and everywhere else in the world would use more energy than can be, you know, generated. Hmm. Certainly more energy that can be generated safely and environmentally soundly. So there is some, we got to start looking inside in a big way, you know, on a mass scale, that humanity has to start looking inside and really doing some soul searching about what are we doing and where are we going? Because there's only so many people that can become, you know, rich and famous and successful. You know, not everybody can become rich and famous and successful. Some people just aren't going to do that. And not everybody can, you know, own an SUV or a big house or whatever. You know, not everybody can consume a lot of energy. And we have to start looking at that collectively. That's why I find what I said earlier about the young people. The young people, I have a teenage son, and he's so non-materialistic. I mean, he likes his toys and whatnot, but he just doesn't see the world as just something to conquer and become rich in. And I find that quite fascinating. I think he depends more on his network of his social network than he does on wanting to become more material, gain more materially. And I think that's a good sign.
Well, that's great. I want to switch the conversation a little bit towards your current film that you're working on, which is a very expansive history of a part of the motion picture industry, which is about the Screen Actors Guild and its history and what it's doing currently. Well, how did you find yourself becoming involved with this project?
Well, like many projects in my life, this is a project I got a phone call. I got a phone call from a friend of a friend who said, we've got this project. It's been attempted to be finished. It's a very large project. There have been attempts to do it. None of them have quite gained enough traction to complete it. And we're looking for somebody to come in and really tell the story. And I had always been fascinated by Hollywood history. I've been in Hollywood and living in Los Angeles since the 1970s, and I've worked on the old lots, Fox and Paramount and Warner Brothers and MGM, and been around the lots and fascinated by the history. And so I thought it was an interesting opportunity to work in history, which I had not really worked in before, and particularly Hollywood history, which I've always had sort of a soft spot for. And I found that in working on this, it's a story that the acting is a very interesting trade, a very interesting craft, and actors are a very interesting bunch of people. I never worked with actors much, even though I'd worked in film and on St. Elsewhere and on Hill Street Blues and on The Rose and in movies and whatnot. It was always in post-production, so I'd never worked with actors directly very much because by the time you're in post-production, the actors are long gone. And then working in documentaries, even though I produced and directed them, I never worked with the actors very much because you don't have actors in documentaries. So this is my first opportunity to really connect with actors. And actors are a very unique bunch of people. And I found that the history of the Screen Actors Guild is a history that most people don't know about and, quite frankly, have probably never thought of. You know, people tend these days to think of actors as famous celebrities who are, sought after and paparazzi and Us Magazine and all that kind of stuff. That we kind of think of acting these days in terms of celebrity, but the fact of the matter is that actors historically were discriminated against. Historically, actors were sort of the rejects of society. They were not respected. Acting was not a respected profession at all. And in terms of the early days in Hollywood, actors were treated just miserably. I mean, in the earliest films, they didn't even have credits. They didn't even have who acted, the names of the actors. And it was only when the studio moguls, realized that people came to movies to see specific actors that they started putting credits on movies so that the public would know that one of their favorite actors or actresses was in a film and thus would come to the theater and watch the movie. And that was really the beginning of the movie star. This was like in the 1920s. And so the bottom line about the Screen Actors Guild is that it's a very interesting example of the fortunate helping the less fortunate. Because there would be no Screen Actors Guild if it wasn't for the movie stars. It was the movie stars that really helped the little guy get the attention of the big studios and start getting fair treatment. The movie's mostly about labor. It's a classic story of the underdog and of big business taking advantage of the little guy. Because in the early days of Hollywood, there was always 10 actors for every part, just like there is now. There was always more actors around than they needed. And so people weren't treated very well. The actors were not treated well at all. And there were a lot of safety concerns. There was a lot of...
Actors did their own stunts in the early days.
Well, they did their own stunts. They had no protection of hours. You'd work 24
insurance.
Hours a day. You had no protection of any sort, whether it's food, rest, location, stunts, all that kind of stuff. And there was a lot of abuse, basically. And so these people got together from New York who had been on the stage and had learned about unionization unionism in New York, came out to Hollywood and said, boy, this place needs some help. And they got together and they spent a long time. They spent about 5 years before they managed to get recognized by the studios as a legitimate union.
That was 1937.
Yeah, 1937. Yeah. And, of course, Ronald Reagan plays a big big role in the Screen Actors Guild history, too. You know, Reagan was president of the Screen Actors Guild for 7 years, went on to become president of the United States, very controversial figure. People love to project their, you know, their frustrations about the president of the United States, Ronald Reagan, onto the president of the Screen Actors Guild, Ronald Reagan. And they really were pretty much two different eras. Same guy, but two different periods of time.
Two different periods of time in his life, too.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Yeah, yeah.
That's another story. Yeah. We're not going to go there. That's a whole other 2 hours worth of stuff. So you'd mentioned we were talking about the Crop Circles movie before, and you said that two things really interest you as far as where you would like to go as a filmmaker in the future, just because we're getting close to the end here. And you said there's two ideas which you're really interested in exploring, and I want to kind of get your take on what do you think you might do. And one is, who's really running the show?
Right.
And the other is, do extraterrestrials really exist? And I don't even like the word extraterrestrials, because I think that there is other dimensions that we can't, you know, exactly from our physical mind frame of reference, we're not so much in touch with. But so what do you think you might do with those two ideas in the future?
Well, there is a point at which they might converge, actually, and that is the whole specter of secret technology that's being harbored by either our government or some weird mishmash of big business and government that supposedly may have in their possession extraterrestrial technology that they have recovered from spacecraft that have crashed and things like that.
Right. I've had several different programs on that subject in the past, and my past program. So yes, that is definitely happening. As I see.
Right. And so that's the nexus of where, who's running the show on here in our world. That's where that element meets the other, or the unknown, or the extraterrestrial. Which I think is, in fact, as I see more and more information on that, is becoming a more and more sophisticated subject, that, in fact, the relationship between crop circles, life after death, time travel, extraterrestrials, UFOs, there may be some interconnectedness. Not that they're all the same thing, but there may be some interrelatedness of all of these different elements at some level. And so, yes, I think both of those subjects are primary to our future. I think people really need to be in control of their own lives, and that governments or corporations or other, you know, institutions really have to be, you know, the people have to take the power into their hands, basically.
Well,
that
William,
power, that power comes from information.
Yeah. Well, film is the way to get it. William, thanks so much for being with us today. Really appreciate your time.
All right.
It's been a great, maybe we'll have you back and continue our conversation again in the future after you get your Screen Actors Guild film completed.
Thank you very much.
Well, anyway, everyone, that's a wrap for our show. Remember, you're the writer, director, producer, and star of your own movie that's called Your Life. So make it a blockbuster and it'll be a classic. Until next time. I'm Randall Barrow for Spirit of Film Conversations. We'll see you next week.